This archived broadcast of Janet Meffer Today is brought to you by TriStar Pictures' A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, based on the true story, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks and Matthew Rhys, rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters November 22nd.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it!
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Thank you for joining us again. In 1644, Scottish churchman Samuel Rutherford published a book challenging the idea in another book of the time that the king is the law and is only answerable to God. Rutherford's book was called Lex Rex, which means that the law is king, and it began in time to change the very structure of nation states and was one of the most influential books in the founding of the United States. And at a time when America has seen the rise of political power grabbers and anarchists and Marxists, and at a time when we are under siege over the role of governance and the rule of law, it really is a critical time for Christians to go back and to re-examine Rutherford's biblical defense of politics as it should be. So we're going to do that with my next guest, who is out with a great book to help us do it. Dr. Michael Milton is interim provost and James H. Ragsdale Chair of Missions and Evangelism at Erskine Theological Seminary. He is out with a wonderful resource, a new annotated version in contemporary English of Lex Rex, so you can read it. The book is called Foundations of a Moral Government. And Dr. Milton, it's so great to talk to you again. How are you?
I'm very well, Janet. Thank you. It's always great to speak with you.
Thank you.
I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, always wonderful to have you here. You know, I am aware that there will be listeners who will be familiar with Lex Rex and Samuel Rutherford.
Yep.
Maybe even some brave souls have read it all in the antiquated language of the time. But tell people a little bit, if you would, about Samuel Rutherford and how it was that he came to write this book, Lex Rex.
Well, Samuel Rutherford was a Scottish Presbyterian minister. He was born in 1600. He lived till 1661. And that just happens to be one of the most tumultuous times in all of English-speaking history, because he went through the English Civil War as well as the National Cabinet in Scotland. And the whole idea, well, what Christopher Hill, Sir Christopher Hill, called those times, the world turned upside down, borrowing the phrase from Acts. And during the English Civil War, the question was put whether divine right of kings is legitimate or not. This really spewed over into every area of life, because at the heart of that question was, shall we have a government that is imposed upon us, or shall we have a government that is actually representative of the people? And does this have any truth claims? Is there empirical evidence? And Samuel Rutherford says there's evidence in Scripture. And so he constructed 44 questions and answers, which was in response to another fellow who had written a defense of the divine right of kings. So the English Civil War is going on. Samuel Rutherford is a member of the Westminster Assembly of Divines, who were called by Parliament to answer the question, what should worship look like in England? What should government look like in England? And Rutherford was very much a part of that. But in addition to that, he wrote this magnificent work, which has tremendous implications for everyday life around the world. As governments emerge, as dictatorships emerge, and as you mentioned, in our own country, where we are increasingly divided over the meaning of our government, the meaning
right.
of our founding.
Right,
and
right.
Rutherford was extraordinarily influential in answering that question.
Well, he was. You point out as well that it wasn't that he was opposed to monarchy as a concept, right? It was just that he
right.
didn't believe in the absolute right of monarchs as having the divine right to dictate to the people what everything ought to be in terms of the law.
That's right. Rutherford, in Lex Rex, defended monarchy, but he said monarchy can only exist as the people allow it to exist. out of that came constitutional monarchy in Great Britain that we know today, which is practiced in all the other Commonwealth, or many of the Commonwealth nations like Australia and Canada.
Yeah.
But also out of that came the concept of a republic, of representative government by the people without monarchy. And that was so influential that it inspired a number of other authors, people like, for instance, John Locke, who wrote about two treaties on government, dealing with the fact that government has to recognize that we are all equal and that we must live out our natural rights in concert with one another, that is, in a under the rule of law. A lot of his thinking was directly from Samuel Rutherford. So I wrote this because twofold. I think we need the truth. Truth will set you free. John 8, and the Bible speaks to the area of government and politics as much as it speaks to the area of marriage or the human soul. Secondly, Rutherford's work is so foundational to our understanding of our republic, of human government, the role and the limitations of human government. But it was delivered in a way that was a polemic, that is, it was a fiery response to another argumentative essay, and it also is filled with references to contemporary issues, which will be lost on the reader today. So that's why I wrote it.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting, we always have to go back if we're talking about trends in world history and try to put ourselves in the shoes of the people who were living there at the time. And I'm sure for a lot of listeners, it's just out of the realm of understanding why in the world you would look at a king and say, this guy has the divine right to tell us all what to do. But why did people at the time believe in the king as law? I mean, other than the fact that monarchy was the norm and people just kind of accepted it. Was there any kind of deeper reason that they accepted that premise?
Yes, in fact, the author of the book that Rutherford is responding to was using plenty of scripture to say that the king is the best, an absolute monarchy is the best form of government because it's imitating God. And that was a bit of sloppy thinking, said Rutherford. And so it did have precedent. Many of the people were told that this is the way it is because it's a reflection of the rule of God. God rules over us through a king. And they would point, for instance, to the theocracy in the Old Testament before Israel, and then when Israel took kings, Saul and David, and those who followed. So, yes, they tried to derive a government based upon biblical examples, but they were not careful in their scriptural exegesis, and as a result, they missed it. We are not like God. There is no human being here like God. In fact, we're sinners saved by grace, and the whole concept of diffidence toward self, that is, a distrust of self, created the concept with Samuel Rutherford of a division of branches within a government that was what we call checks and balances.
Right. All the way back to 1644. It's kind of interesting because if you're trying to make a biblical case that there is a divine right of kings, it would seem that the Old Testament itself would argue against that just when you look at the history of how many horrible kings there were in the history of Israel. I mean, there it is, right in plain sight.
Absolutely. They may, if they were to say they had a divine right, they certainly didn't display divine behavior.
There you go.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so there is a natural, there should be a distrust. The other part of that, though, is the social contract. This was very big with Rutherford, and it was carefully put together by Hobbes and other, John Locke particularly. Yeah. And the social contract is that I have rights, but my rights must be lived in relationship to your rights. So I can't obliterate your rights with my rights. That the government rules because we allow it to rule.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very quick break. We'll come back with Dr. Michael Milton, his book, Foundations of a Moral Government. Stay with us. We'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today.
From TriStar Pictures comes A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, based on the true story of the real-life friendship between Fred Rogers and a cynical journalist, showing that kindness can triumph.
You love broken people like me.
Sometimes we have to ask for help, and that's okay.
A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks and Matthew Rhys. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested. In theaters November 22nd. More information is available online at resources.abeautifulday.movie.
If you're a medical professional, here's a way to move from success to even greater significance. Mercy Ships has an urgent need for pediatric registered nurses. You'll be joining dozens of volunteer medical professionals who've been blessed by the opportunity.
I think all nurses should do something like this. To serve the unserved is one of the most beautiful experiences.
Get more information by visiting mercyships.org/nurses. Mercy Ships, bringing hope and healing to the world's forgotten poor.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $249 for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com, and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. We are back on Janet Mefford Today, and if you want to understand the foundations of the United States and the way that we think about government, you need to know about Samuel Rutherford and his classic book, Lex Rex, The Law is King, Not the King is Law, as was a popular view in his own day. And now Dr. Michael Milton is out with a new annotated version in contemporary English of Lex Rex, Foundations of a Moral Government. Dr. Milton, you were saying something really important before we had to go to the last break, and that was that the social contract was very big with Samuel Rutherford, this idea that I have rights, but those rights have to be lived out in relationship to your rights. Why was that such a real change in the way that people had expressed how to live out your life, especially as a Christian? Because Romans 13, I know, has been interpreted different ways depending on the divine right of kings argument versus Lex Rex. But can you get into that a little bit and explain why it was he came to that conclusion from a biblical perspective?
Well, remember, they were in the midst of the Civil War. And as we are today in the midst of an ideological civil war,
yes.
Most people believe the nation is split. They certainly were split then. And part of the thinking that flows from a divine right of kings is if the king says it, you should do it. You should follow it. And therefore, if he says that, for instance, in their day, the issue Anglicanism or Arminianism, a particular form of Anglicanism, of the Protestant faith, has to be lived thusly. You must worship thusly. Rutherford says, no, that's not right. The king, it does not have absolute authority, and therefore, each and every human being must judge for himself or herself whether this is right or not, and whether it's good for me and for my family.
Right.
So the social contract is the and incidentally, that word doesn't occur until John Locke, but that was John Locke was taking his ideas from Rutherford, that we live in concert with one another, allowing each other to express ideas, what George Washington would coin as cooperation without compromise in terms of the way we, speaking of religion. But it was a government by for the people, in which all the people are able to live, express their opinions, express their ideas, but in concert with one another.
Yes.
And the government was to protect that, what he felt was a right of conscience. And so government was there, indeed, as a representative, according to Romans 13, to protect the natural rights of God, the God-given rights. They were not government-granted.
Right. Sounds very familiar, doesn't it, to every American listening? Yeah, exactly. You had summarized Samuel Rutherford's political philosophy by citing this line: man by nature is under government paternal, not politic properly, but by the free consent of his will. Again, a very American idea, but a very biblical idea. I mean, this is going back to the Word of God, which I think is so important to emphasize.
Oh, absolutely. Whether you're talking about Rutherford's work, and he was a minister, or whether you're talking about John Locke, he was a physician as well as a philosopher, but first of all, a surgeon. Whether you're talking about Benjamin Franklin, whether you're talking about any of the other founders, they were appealing to the religion, if you will, of Jesus Christ, the Judeo-Christian faith, which was pervasive and which had formed Western civilization, but, as we can see, was still being worked out. I maintain that Rutherford's ideas achieved their greatest summit in the Constitution of the United States, which is a beautiful example of the social contract underneath the Creator.
That's right. That's right. It's interesting. Another point that is so significant that Rutherford took up was the fact that if the state is contradicting God's law, then that's an act of tyranny. This was another big thing of the founders. They said the same thing.
Right.
They fought an American Revolution over what they rightly called tyranny from the British crown. So what of this? What biblical defense did he give? Because you cite in the book 1 Chronicles 12, David defending himself against King Saul. Was that Rutherford's justification as well for that position?
That was exactly Rutherford's justification. We could also cite, of course, the book of Acts and Peter saying, shall we obey man or God, when told that he's to shut up and not preach. So tyranny is, as Francis Schaeffer also noted several decades ago, is something that must be opposed. We cannot allow tyranny to happen. A divine right of kings philosophy reemerges whenever it does. So the people have the right, again, a God-given right of conscience. And that conscience must be exercised. Government is not there to inhibit it, but to allow it to flourish. And that was the unique and the glorious brilliance of the American Constitution.
Well, now, how would he deal with issues like limited government and the rule of law? How did he address those issues in Lex Rex?
Well, both of those are at the heart of Lex Rex. Limited government being that government is there to provide, protect property, to protect life, to protect the conscience, all the God-given rights, which incidentally, since our country seems to be embroiled in a bit of a argument about socialism, he of course would absolutely reject it, as would all of them at that time on both sides, because it simply is stealing. It has nothing. It's not from God. God has said that property rights, the free rights of conscience and so forth, these are things that God has given us. And so Rutherford says government should be doing that. They shouldn't be doing other things. And we don't have time necessarily to go into all that, but he certainly declares limited government as representative. The government does what the people say they can do and no more.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, unless people think that he was just embraced and applauded across the spectrum, his book was burned, right? And he was charged with treason. He got in big trouble for saying these things in his own day.
Well, he did get in big trouble. And interestingly enough, he was against the regicide of Charles I, the beheading of Charles I. He did not go along with the more radical elements of 17th century England, Wales, and Scotland. He was against it, as were most of the Scottish commissioners. They were absolutely supportive of monarchy, but they wanted constitutional monarchy. When Charles II, the son of the beheaded king, returns from Spain at the Restoration, first thing he does is says, we've got to burn this book, because he said, we've got to return to a divine right of kings. This man is spreading sedition, and he's got to be removed from St. Andrew's University, where he was a professor, and furthermore, he should not be allowed to die a natural death. However, the Lord intervened, and Rutherford died, an old man.
Right.
At least an old man of that day. I'm actually a little older than Samuel Rutherford.
Old is relative, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, but I mean, that's a significant thing for people to understand, that those who are our forebears in fighting for principles we take for granted did not get off easy in trailblazing the way that they did, in particular Rutherford. What do you think Rutherford would think of the state of the United States at the moment? You cited, you know, the fact that we have all this political, you know, insanity going on, more and more support for socialism. We have more and more political resistance that is turning violent, and less and less adherence to the U.S. Constitution as originally given to us, less adherence to the principles that made America great. In fact, there's a huge, I would say, fight against what has made America great to dissemble it. And what are your thoughts on that, even reflecting as a theologian on what's going on in the United States?
Well, I think that, of course, I wouldn't presume to know exactly what he would say, but I can guarantee you that he would likely see a divine judicial response to the sinfulness in the United States, whether those are sin of abortion, sensual, allowing sensuality to rule in our lives, and he would respond to say there's likely a judicial hardening, a judicial removal of protection, whereby we are thinking nonsense.
Yeah.
Whether we, if there's only, for instance, there's only two sexes, is male and female chromosomes. We can't talk about a third gender,
right,
for instance.
Right.
And yet, we can't, nor can we talk of political philosophies in a nonsensical way. It leads to oppression. It leads ultimately to the to hurting God's creation. And that's why I, as a theologian, as a pastor, want to speak and to say these are relevant issues for a pastor to speak to, because it deals with humanity. It deals with God's creation. And God did not tell the minister to stop at the shoreline of ecclesiology or the church, but every area of life should be subject to the truth.
Amen.
Of the gospel of Jesus Christ.
That's right. That's right. That's so well said, and I couldn't agree with you more. And I think this is such an important book for people to read, Dr. Milton. I'm so delighted that you put this into English that everybody can understand, and that it will give people more access to the ideas in Lex Rex. Let me give out the title again. It's called Foundations of a Moral Government by Dr. Michael Milton. It went so fast, but thank you so much, Dr. Milton.
Yep.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Janet. Lord bless you.
You Bye-bye. Too. God bless you. We'll be back on Janet Mefford Today right after this. This archived broadcast of Janet Mefford Today is brought to you by TriStar Pictures, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, based on the true story, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks and Matthew Rhys. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters November 22nd. We are back on Janet Mefford today. One of my favorite themes to sing about is the promise of heaven. Think about some of these great lyrics from the old hymn. When we all get to heaven, what a day of rejoicing that will be. When we all see Jesus, we'll sing and shout the victory. It's hard to just say that. I feel like singing it. But have you ever wondered what the backstory is on some of these great songs and hymns about heaven? We're going to talk about it today with award-winning author Ace Collins as he discusses his book, Stories Behind the Songs and Hymns About Heaven. And it's great to have you with us, Ace. How are you doing?
It's a joy to be with y'all. I am doing well. It's really fun to talk about this book. The idea came from Greg Johnson, who is my literary agent. He had been to his mother-in-law's funeral, and he came back to me, and he said, I know you've got a lot of stories behind books. Have you ever thought about doing the stories behind songs about heaven? And in truth, I hadn't. And as I got to researching and working on this particular book, I found myself intrigued and also wishing I had done it much earlier. I 3 years ago, my father died of cancer. It would have been nice to have had the stories behind these songs in my head as I sit by his bed. 2 years ago, my mother got Alzheimer's. The amazing thing about that was there was a girls' social club from the university where my wife teaches that went out and sang songs, and one of the songs they sang was Victory in Jesus, to the Alzheimer's ward out there, the dementia ward. And my mother, who didn't even know who I was at that time and had problems carrying on a conversation, had no problem remembering all the words to Amazing Grace and Victory in Jesus.
Wow.
So I think that really did project the power of these hymns to be imprinted almost on our DNA, and therefore finding out the stories behind them, finding not how many of these stories were tragic in nature, and yet faith endured in spite of that tragedy, makes these stories much, much more meaningful.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what you say, that a lot of these hymns really have kind of a sad backstory, that the person who wrote the hymn was struggling in different ways. Different hymn writers were struggling in different ways. What about Eliza Hewitt? Because Eliza Hewitt wrote When We All Get to Heaven, which I just quoted. What's the story behind that one?
Well, Hewitt, a bright young woman raised as an only kid in a family that taught her to be educated, to question, to reason, to think, to push herself beyond being considered a second-class citizen, which is what women were considered in the 1850s and 60s. And so she was taught that she had a purpose as great as any man, and she accepted the calling of being a teacher in the classroom, working with underprivileged kids in a poor district. She ultimately met with tragedy because one of her students hit her with a slate, and in knocking her down, badly injured her. She was never supposed to walk again, and yet she, through sheer determination, taught herself how to walk, first a few steps at a time, and eventually where she could walk two or three blocks and get outside and get away from this room that she had been trapped in. And she began to develop writing skills, and it was common in this particular point in time. Poetry was the big thing, to write poetry.
Right.
And so she wrote a lot of poetry, and a lot of that centered on her faith and also her questions. And eventually, one of those poems, There Is Sunshine in My Soul, was published, followed by More About Jesus, followed by My Faith Has a Resting Place. And they became Christian standards. And she began to go to evangelical meetings, what we would call revivals. It was the big time of Dwight Moody and those people as they were circulating throughout the United States with their revivals and their week-long meetings in various places. And she came up after meeting Franny Crosby, the great blind songwriter,
yes,
with a concept of what heaven was going to be like. Mm-hmm. And she wrote the words and fortunately passed them on to a lady that she had met at one of these meetings. And, you know, the clincher in this was dying meant victory because it allowed Christians to come together as believers without walls. And I think that was the big thing for her. She was very vibrant in the civil rights movement at that time. She was working with ex-slaves. She was someone who believed in the equality of all men, and that's what God taught in the Bible and what Jesus stood for. And so by working with Emily Wilson, she actually created this crowning effort, if you can, in her life, which I think, realistically speaking, if you read all of the verses, you know, first verse, fighting off crippling pain. The second verse, you know, you're growing. You're actually trying to reach out to those who are here on earth. Last verse, the reward. When you look at all those verses combined, it really tells her life story.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. Well, and there are so many others that you highlight. For example, and I tried to pick out some of the ones that most people will probably know, but you think of the Negro spiritual, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. I think everybody knows that one. Wallace Willis, who penned that one. But what was the story behind that? Because, you know, in all honesty, I never really knew the story behind Swing Low, Sweet Chariot until I picked up your book.
It's one of the few what we call Negro spirituals that we actually know the author of. And it's interesting that his life, you know, began life as a slave owned by, ironically enough, by a Choctaw Indian in Alabama. And when Choctaws were forced to go, like the Cherokees, on the Trail of Tears and move to reservations, they also lost their ability to own property, and Willis was a property. And so he, though, had to follow his master into Oklahoma, the Indian Territory. And he was a man who taught himself how to read. He was a student of the Bible. He worked with a local children's school as a janitor. He was somebody who constantly was looking ways to take these students, many of whom were Native Americans, and give them something where they could learn more about the faith that he had embraced as a child, the Christian faith. And in the process, he thought about the book of Ezekiel, thought about the great story of the chariot. And he also combined that a little bit, too, with the knowledge that was common with a lot of African Americans at the time. The Jordan River was important to them. You know, there's another Negro spiritual in this book, well, that was adapted into a Negro spiritual, Roll Jordan Roll,
yeah,
that emphasizes that as well. And on the other side of the river was freedom. And that's what heaven was for people who had been enslaved. It was freedom. Finally, you'd leave the chains of this earth and go to heaven, where you would be treated as an equal, where God loved you, where you wouldn't be classified as three-fifths of a person, which these people were at that particular point. And he wrote this. Now, he taught it to the children. The children loved it. We should not know it, except somebody came by and listened to it. And that somebody who listened to this song at the old Spencer Academy, you know, was Alexander Reed. He grabbed onto it and took it back to Nashville, Tennessee, where he was from, and gave it to the Fisk Jubilee Singers, the greatest spiritual choir in history, no doubt about it. They were led by a man named Warwick, who collected Negro spirituals, and he immediately adapted this as one of the closers they used in concerts. And it was so popular that the Queen and King of England in a royal performance asked to hear it 3 and 4 times in a row.
Oh, wow.
And so it is probably the best known of all of our Negro spirituals, but we can actually pin this to Wallace Willis, a former slave who found freedom in American Indian country in the what we now know as Oklahoma.
So interesting. And you also say, even though this was a song inspired by the Old Testament, it has a New Testament message, which is absolutely true.
Think, you know, if we're dealing with heaven, we're going to be dealing with New Testament messages, too. You know, I think Jordan, the River Jordan, is mentioned in the Bible 190 times. And most of us, you know, crossing Jordan was a very important part, obviously, for Moses. But we have used it symbolically since then as getting from this life to the next. When Negro slaves would sing Roll Jordan Roll in the field, it was a sign that one of them was going to try to escape that night and get across the Ohio River. And the Ohio River, in their mind, was symbolic of Jordan. And therefore, if you cross that river, you know, you release the chains. You're free. And so, you know, the water of baptism and Jesus and the Jordan and all this. So all of these river motifs in songs about heaven relate to Jesus being baptized and also the Old Testament.
Yeah. Ace, hang on just a moment. We have to pause for a quick break. Stories behind the songs and hymns about heaven. We'll be right back on Janet Meffer Today.
I was afraid. I was scared. I didn't know what to do. Everybody wanted me to have an abortion.
But he was like, you're not ready for another baby. And at that moment, I felt that I'm not going to be able to be a mom to this baby.
These are the voices that a young mom in crisis hears. She wants to make the right choice, but society and those around her are telling her that a preborn baby is not a life. Preborn is the largest provider of free ultrasounds in the country, shining a light into a mother's womb, introducing her to the beautiful life growing inside of her.
She said, "There go the heartbeat." That changed my life just from that ultrasound picture.
Would you join with Preborn and Janet Mefford today to help save 400 babies by the end of the year? For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds and help save 5 babies from abortion. And now through a match, your gift is doubled. All gifts are tax deductible. To donate, dial 1-855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229, or there's a banner at janetmefford.com.
From TriStar Pictures comes A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, based on the true story of the real-life friendship between Fred Rogers and a cynical journalist, showing that kindness can triumph.
You love broken people, like me.
Sometimes we have to ask for help, and that's okay.
A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks and Matthew Rhys. Rated PG, parental guidance suggested. In theaters November 22nd. More information is available online at resources.abeautifulday.movie.
If you're looking for adventure, serving as a volunteer on the Mercy Ship is an adventure like no other. And you'll be serving on the largest non-governmental hospital ship in the world, providing free care to some of the world's poorest people. Whether it's performing a surgery, cleaning the deck, or transporting a patient to a recovery center, every day you'll be making a difference in the lives of struggling people. Begin your adventure today. Connect with us at mercyships.org. It's an adventure of a lifetime.
We are back on Janet Mefford today. Great to have you with us and great to be talking with award-winning author Ace Collins. The book is called Stories Behind the Songs and Hymns About Heaven. And I love so many of these hymns and songs that you've included in the book. Ace, we were talking a little bit about, in particular, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, Wallace Willis, and the Negro spiritual that everybody will know and the backstory there. But, you know, when we're talking about rivers and you mentioned how important it was, the theme of the Jordan River and, you know, Jordan River and the Bible and how much this imagery comes up, you've got another hymn that you mentioned in the book, Shall We Gather at the River. Can you talk about that one and what the backstory is to that one?
Yeah. Robert Lowry was the writer of that song, and Lowry had grown up on the Ohio River. So obviously the river was very important to his life. There was a song, in other words, there was a back when America was going west, and everything that took you west at that particular point was the river. The Ohio River took you to Indiana, Illinois, and the Western Territories. So he looked at the river, you know, as a conduit, that, as a child, that took you to great adventures. And then when he became a preacher, and it was in the midst of the Civil War, the river also took people away to war that never came back. And so he was in the midst of a time when one out of three people at max went to church. America was not in the days of before the Civil War a country where everybody went to church. About 30% of the people did.
Oh, wow.
And so he was, the congregation that was coming in and he was seeing on a daily basis was, because of the Civil War, was filled up with people who normally didn't come to church. And they had lost loved ones. And he had to come up with an answer. And so he was looking at the book of Revelation one day in his study, very hot day, and he couldn't cool off. And he began to look at all the imagery in Revelation about a river and about other things. And I think the miracle of this thing was most preachers who read Revelation go back and scare their congregation to death with what they say. You know, here's a man who found something positive that would soothe and comfort the congregation. He looked at a life where the river was leading to a place where we would all gather again together. Right. And therefore, it would be like a picnic on the grounds that were so common back then, as they gathered along the river and had their picnics and sang their hymns. This was the great reunion. And so when he wrote that, you know, he was using Revelation in a very much different way than most people do. He was announcing, it was really announcing not as much wrath and destruction as it was bringing people together and the comfort that went with that.
Wow.
You know, when I was asked to write this book, it was fascinating because I wrote too many stories. There were too many great stories to go in one book. And so I sent them too much material. And the editors came back to me and they said, well, you know, we're going to cut this to 30 songs. And I said, okay, but I've got one favor to ask. And I said, you can cut out what songs you want to cut out, but the book has to begin with Wayfaring Stranger and it has to end with Victory in Jesus.
Right.
And those were my two directives in writing this. And I wanted to hang on to those two songs because I thought they were the bookends this project needed to really tell the full story of not just going to heaven, but most of these songs talk about bringing a bit of heaven to earth and our ability as Christians to do that for people who are lost.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. So talk about those two hymns then. When you're talking about Wayfaring Stranger and Victory in Jesus, you know, people will know these songs. But what makes them bookends, would you say?
I start with Wayfaring Stranger because I think it is the story of the Good Samaritan. It is a story of a man or a woman, whoever wrote the song, who is going from place to place. Obviously, they're probably either displaced or a refugee. They're very poor. And they're looking for someone to reach out and comfort them, someone to offer them a hand, someone to offer them food, clothing, and they continually get passed by. And yet they have tremendous faith, and they know that when they get to heaven, they won't be passed by, that Jesus will welcome them with open arms and give them everything they need. They will be loved for the first time. They will be accepted for the first time. And I think Wayfaring Stranger is a wonderful story in a song format that is much like the Good Samaritan. We need to be looking for these people, not looking in the mirror as much as looking outside the window for people who literally are, you know, as a pastor would say, going through hell here on earth. And we need to show them that the heaven is there for them and they don't have to wait till they die. They can actually experience some of it right now. And the way that happens is for us to share a bit of our faith, a bit of our heaven on earth with them. And I thought it was very, very important to start the book with that. Victory in Jesus, meanwhile, that I ended the book with, I think is one of the most incredible films, I mean, one of the most incredible hymns ever written. And I think it is because of the story behind it. You have Eugene Bartlett, one of the greatest hymn writers of all time, wrote over 500 hymns. I mean, this is a man who was brilliant. His ability to shape thoughts into music, gosh, you know, has there ever been anybody like him? I always refer to him in a way, if people saw the recent PBS Country Music Special, as the Hank Williams of gospel music, because he could take things that were simple, put them in a simple format, and give us complex thoughts that we could understand in music. And he wrote so many great songs. Everybody Will Be Happy Over There, Camping in Canaan Land, Set My Soul on Fire. He also wrote some country songs that are kind of fun. I mean, you know, like Take an Old Cold Tater and Wait. But he was returning at 53 years old from a tour across the world. He had sung before kings. He was a very important person in the Great Depression. He never got poor because of how well his songs sold. And people always said if he was ever challenged, if everything didn't go his way, he would lose his faith. On this train coming back, he had a stroke. And by the time he got to his home, he could not even form a word. He was stuck in his bed. He could go nowhere. He'd gone from a world to a room in a brief instant. And people were watching to find out when Bartlett was going to lose his faith. And they watched him over the course of several weeks form his hand into a fist. And they were waiting for him to raise that fist in the air and curse God. Look, what have you done this to me? And instead, he jammed a pencil into that fist. And over the course of the next 2 months, it took him 2 months now to do this, a man who normally wrote a song in 15, 20 minutes, 2 months of constant work and sweating, wrote his testimony that showed he had not lost his faith, and a man who could no longer sing gave us Victory in Jesus.
Oh, wow.
And Victory in Jesus, if you read the words, the first verse and the second verse talks about his trials, talks about the weakness, talks about the illness, but the mere fact that at the end there is victory. And I think it's one of the most powerful powerful song stories I've ever come across in my entire life.
That is so
great. Of course,
he
died before it was even actually ever published.
What a great song, though. What a great legacy. Do you have a particular favorite out of all the hymns and songs about heaven that you studied and all the stories that you came across? Did one just as a hymn that you would sing in church or sing at home, is there one in particular that you like the best?
I don't know. I think there are so many great stories in each one of these. They all come away being your children, and each one has a different selling point. But I do think when you look at a story, when you look at the stories and you realize that Beyond the Sunset was inspired by a man who couldn't see, you know, in the midst of a thunderstorm rolling in and all those other things, he watched a sunset with his mind over the waters, you know, and told the songwriter, you know, that's the most beautiful sunset I've ever seen. And I think when you're looking at that, you know, you're looking at the ability of a believer to see beyond what he can visually process, and therefore go into a place where he has shown, if you will, in his mind, all the beauty and glory that is heaven. And I think that's maybe an example of what a lot of us see. We get lost in a world of woe, if you will, and fail to see the blessings that are all around us, and also fail to see the opportunities to help.
Yeah.
I was struck as I wrote this book, and the scripture that came back to me time and time again was Christ's directive to his disciples in Matthew 25:35-40, reaching out to the least of these, because at least half of these songwriters were the least of these.
Oh man. That's
and yet
neat.
They found grace.
Yeah. No,
nothing's more clear than good old gospel ship, which was written by a former slave.
That is so neat. Well, people can read all of these stories in the book. It's called Stories Behind the Songs and Hymns About Heaven by Ace Collins. And Ace, it was so good to have you here. Thank you very, very much for being with us.
God bless you all and have a wonderful, wonderful day.
Well, you too. God bless you, Ace. Thanks for joining us on Janet Mefford today. We always appreciate you tuning in and are grateful for you. We'll see you next time right here. God bless.